T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Good morning, and welcome to another edition of Better Living, a show about people and organizations that make an impact around Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm your host, Chris Arnold of 105.3 The Fan, and we want to thank everyone for joining us. Our first guests today are Bill and Vicki Atkins. Bill and Vicki Atkins have started the Brett Atkins Foundation, and since this is the time of the year where a lot of high school kids are applying for grants, I thought this would be a great opportunity to talk about the Brett Atkins Foundation and how you're offering scholarships that are somewhat unusual. It's about scholarships for kids who say no to drugs. Is that right, Bill?
Yeah, that is exactly right. Yeah, and I won't say they've all had some association or been, you know, around it or seen it or been scared by it mm-hmm. or actually had tragedy. But we do what we can and try to, you know, one thing that I think does happen is people, you know, kind of set off on a mission statement and they get, sidetracked with all the different various things. And we stayed pretty true to the course, and it's really worked well.
So these scholarships for the kids, the high school kids who say no to drugs, what made you start doing this? And Vicki, you could answer that.
Well, being a parent of a son that did experience in drugs and alcohol, you know, we all make mistakes and we all, you know, could do better with the choices that we make. Brett, you know, was a great kid, made some stupid choices, didn't need to. I'm alive today, but I just think that it's only by the grace of God that I am. But when it comes to Brett and his choices, you know what, he was very unfortunate and something that was just, you know, just didn't have to happen, happened, and it cost him his life.
You know, there's there's a lot of families that are experiencing situations like this where you're trying to raise your kids the right way, and they get influences from their peer groups. Bill, could you talk about what kind of kid Brett was, and then exactly what happened to him? I know it's kind of personal.
Well, hey, you know, he's like every high school kid, you know, he wanted to play football, you know. He had this crazy personality. He was so, he's just one of those kids, you know, that like when he showed up, I mean, he was the star of the show. I mean, he just had this amazing personality.
Charismatic.
Crazy. Yeah, very charismatic. And, you know, I think the fact that you know, he was always trying to be, he wanted everybody's approval. And, you know, one of the things, you know, that got him in trouble a little bit, he got into social media and he mm-hmm. was always trying to show off a little bit like we see kids do every day. And I'm mm-hmm. like going, oh, my God. You know, and at the end of the day is what happened to our son is he got put together in a botched robbery and he was murdered. And
oh,
he was shot on Christmas Eve. He died on Christmas Day. You know, there was, you know, it was 10:30 at night. He passed away at 1 o'clock on Christmas Day. There was absolutely nothing that we could do. It was just one of those things. You just can't believe it was your child. And, you know, we're more than privileged. And at the end of the day, I mean, it was so something that you would never expect in 10 million years, I never in my life ever thought that I'd, you know, lose a child that way of all crazy things. It was just a horrible experience for us. So, you know, one of the things that we did, like I said, we got so, you know, sidetracked with all these different things. We tried to figure out what was one thing that mm-hmm. we could do. And we came up with, hey, we can't save all the kids that are coming through school. You know, and teenagers, it's just an impossible task, but we can do it one student at a time. And that's one of the things that we found. When we stay with that one kid at a time, we can make a difference. And we have made a difference. And it's exciting. And, as you can tell in my voice, it gets me excited just to know that we've taken a kid that didn't have a chance and given him a chance. And then we watched him flourish.
Mm-hmm.
It's more exciting when you watch a kid that, and we got one in particular, I won't mention his name, but, I mean, he literally watched his father pass away during an overdose, and he was right there. And there, he was in his early teens. He had no idea what to do, call 911, but by the time everybody got there, his dad was gone. And he was just a lost, kid. And, he applied for the scholarship, and, he's going to seminary school. He's got straight A's, and, I mean, he sends us this crazy letter about how, this foundation is everything to him. And we get all kinds of letters like that from the kids that we send to college. And it's just, it's just one of those things. Hey, we can't, like we said, we're going to work on it one kid at a time. And we found that we can make a difference that way.
This is so impressive because you're turning a tragedy into a blessing. This is Vicky and Bill Atkins with the Brett Atkins Foundation. How old was Brett when he passed away?
17.
Oh, my. And, you're talking about the drugs that are out there. I think in the country today, a lot of people are focusing on the opioid crisis. Could you talk about some of the different influences of drugs that may be around in schools that parents maybe have no idea about?
Well, hey, that's one of the things that we did with a couple of big North Texas high schools is we actually met with a couple of the the in-school narcotics off-duty officers.
Sure.
And they talked about, like, I'm in my early 60s, and when I was growing up, pot was grown on weeds, and
mm-hmm.
They weren't perfect. In today's world, they are perfect. They're made in labs, and all these artificial drugs that are made overseas, they're all made by scientists,
and they're stronger. They're stronger,
way stronger, and kids got no idea. And unfortunately, the real expensive drugs that are imported, and a lot of them are from China.
Mm-hmm.
They are so inexpensive, and they're so easy to get in because they're so small and they're so deadly. These kids don't know what they're doing, and they have no idea about what they're getting into. And unfortunately, with COVID, we haven't been able to do a lot of things because we haven't had school. But one of the things that we do, and we will do once they get back in school full force, is we'll geofence a lot of high schools and just put little ads out there so that, when a kid Googles,
mm-hmm.
something like FinFin or whatever, a little ad will come up and explain to him exactly what that is, where it's coming from, and how it's made and how dangerous it is.
Yeah.
Because they just don't know.
Yeah, they just don't know. You mentioned FinFin. Can you talk about some of the other, like, some people just think, okay, maybe it's just weed and maybe weed isn't that bad. But what about, like, some of these synthetic drugs that are out there? The kids are able to get pills so easily. And I guess some of them are called designer drugs and some of them are more accessible. And you probably have an idea of how kids actually get a hold of some of these things. You mentioned through the mail, but also amongst each other.
Yeah, no, and the problem is it's so, as technology continues to improve,
mm-hmm.
Just think about where we are today. We're having this conference call, but
right.
You can just imagine where, they've invented these, in small places and small, in China, for instance, just in a room 10 by 10, they're able with technology to make these just amazing, powerful synthetic drugs that, one of the things that I was just totally horrified when I was growing up, they were called the dots, and they were just on a piece of paper, and they're all multicolored, and it was just a,
mm-hmm.
It was a candy that you'd buy at the five and dime store. Well, now they make, the synthetics, and that's how they sell it, on little pieces of paper, and that's literally all they are, is a dot. But they get a bad a bad dose, and they're dead.
That's it.
And that's that. And kids don't think twice about it. Hey, their buddy did it, heard about it last week. So, hey, they're going to try it this week. And next thing you know, and it's not always, a lot of times they don't overdose. They make horrible decisions, and we found it trying to personally, Vicki and I, you just can't do enough to get your arms around that just in North Texas. I mean, I'd like to say, hey, we're going to solve the problem. And that's kind of where we went in the beginning. But at the end of the day, it's a lot bigger problem than our charity. And we just couldn't swallow it all. But we did find that we could take, individuals and take them out of their terrible situation and improve their lives. And once you see it work, you kind of like, hey, we're like everybody, creatures of habit. If it works, we're just going to do it over and over again.
Now, you guys have given out 27 scholarships every year, $5,000 scholarships, 27 of them. Vicki, is there significance to the number 27?
Yes. It was Brett's favorite number, and it was his football jersey. And so after Brett's passing, I can't tell you how many times a day we see the number 27, especially me. I look at my phone, it's 727. I see license plates all day, every day with the number 27. Mm-hmm. And anyway, yes, it's a huge number. We live on the 27th floor. So Brett's with us at all times.
Could you talk about what you would say to parents that may be experiencing some of the same things? They notice some changes in their kids or the things that you went through that they may be seeing in their own kids?
Well, hey, I tell you this, is first of all, just, everybody thinks like, I'm no different. I mean, we were, definitely, well-to-do and very privileged family. And you just don't think that there's any way. And that's where I think, hey, it's not my kid. Or my kid's not involved in that, or I really didn't think much about how in depth Brett was in social media, mm-hmm. but I knew he was, his friends were all there, but I didn't know that there were strangers there watching my son, hey, one of the things that he did was, he showed off, he borrowed one of my watches, fancy Rolex, and he's on social media wearing that, and borrowed my Gucci shoes, and before you know it, he put a big target on his back,
happens? I'm going to tell you this right now. In this day and age, so many kids on social media want to be a Kardashian. It's about the look and what you look like on Instagram and Snapchat and impressing or pretending to have a certain lifestyle. And that's how they get caught up. That's part of it.
Yes, absolutely. And if I were to talk to parents today, I would say, don't turn a blind eye. These kids are, they have choices in front of them every single day. And starting in middle school, mm-hmm. we're experiencing with the vape pens and
the vapes.
Then it goes from there. Then we go to weed, and then we have coke, and we have it just, and then drinking, and they're just, your kid is not invisible, and they're not above the law. Like, I mean, sometimes I think Brett thought that you have no idea the choices that you make, and it might be your first time trying drinking or drugs. It can cost you your life. And, these parents, some people I know don't say a word to their children. And, you got to just meet them where they're at instead of just yelling at them or grounding them or whatnot. Let's just have that conversation. Slow down and have a conversation with your kids and say, look, I caught this. I saw this in your car. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it. Why are you doing that? Why do you feel like you have to numb yourself to the pain that you're going through or whatever it is? And, get them in a program or get them to talk to somebody. If they don't want to talk to you, mom and dad, send them to somebody else that will listen to them, because they're crying out. They're trying to fill a void that will never be filled unless, they figure their life out. And, to me, get God in your life, because you're not going to make it without him.
Exactly. And in fact, I always say to different people, you can't keep your kids off of social media because it's in all the different peer groups,
right.
And it's just everywhere. But all you can try to be is a greater influence. And you just said it best, Vicky. It's about communication. You want to try to find out what's going on with them and listen to them if they have something to say. And maybe
right.
you can influence them to either not do something or slow down doing it or seek some help.
Absolutely. And after Brett passed away, I opened my home on Wednesday nights to, 14 to 20-year-olds. And they would come in. I'd feed them some good old homemade macaroni and cheese and cookies. And, they would come in and, they would write down on a piece of paper what they were struggling with. Nobody put their name on it, put it in a box. We drew what the conversation was about and had that conversation. And that's these kids coming and talking about their life, their world, and, helping one another with what their struggles were. And at the end of the day, I would say, if you came and you didn't get what you came for, then that's not on me. That's you.
Yeah.
So, we just need to talk.
We're talking with Bill and Vicky Atkins. And Bill, how did you guys happen to choose to do this, the scholarships, where you could have gone on with your life? Again, you could have done some things more privately to grieve or, move on with your lives, but you decided to give out scholarships to families and kids who said no to drugs. How did you come to that decision, and why did you choose this path?
Well, again, like I said, I own several companies here in North Texas, and Brett actually owned a big piece of one, and Brett and my daughter. And at the end of the day, he's a millionaire. I hate to say that, but he was. And when he passed away, my daughter inherited his money.
Mm-hmm.
And she just looked at me, after a couple of weeks of us fighting through all this and said, "Dad, I don't need Brett's money. Let's do something else with it." And I said, I just kind of looked at her and go, cause she's at the end of the day, she's like any, teenage girl. Mm-hmm. I mean, she wants everything. And,
sure.
And we did in the beginning. We kind of struggled what to do, and thank God for Cheryl Jackson. She really kind of helped us with the foundation and kind of put us in the right directions and keeps us going where we're going. And one thing I might, in today's world, one of the things that's unusual is like this whole thing happened over a pot brownie. If you think about that, and
wow.
we still believe it came from Colorado. And what I mean by that is it was literally, bought in Colorado legally and got here.
Mm-hmm.
And again, social media, Brett's, on there with his friends and everything else. But at the same time, there are people lurking out there that decided that they wanted his watch, his shoes, and his truck.
Mm-hmm.
And he shows up at a terrible decision, shows up in the middle of nowhere on Christmas Eve, right, and gets robbed. And that's exactly, you sit there and go, "Hey, it couldn't happen to my kid." Well, my kid did it, and I still don't know why. His ability to prosper was zero. I mean, and at the end of the day, he ended up dead over it, and it could only imagine a big football player, Chris, and, a couple of, he's with his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And you could only imagine a couple of kids say, "Hey, we were going to steal all your stuff." What's a 17-year-old kid that's, 6'3", 220, tell him.
He's going to say, no, you're not taking my stuff. Right, and so they wind up having a fight, and then it goes worse, and he gets murdered.
And unfortunately, my son was winning. And when, people get desperate, right, and at the end of the day, the guy pulled out a gun out of the city and shot him when they were on the ground. And, it was just beyond imagination. We're coming up on 4 years here this Christmas, and it just lingers. I was at his grave yesterday. I still can't believe it. It's
17 just, years old.
Yeah, 17 years old.
He had a saying, "We got this." Can you talk about the meaning of that and where you guys go with it? Because "we got that" is a phrase.
Well, hey, and it's on my airplane. I learned how to fly. One of the things I learned to do was to fly an airplane because it was my greatest fear. And one of the things a guy taught me was, is, hey, the only way to get through this thing is face a couple of your biggest fears. Anyway, I did it. But Brett, you know, like, you know, anytime I was like, hey, son, you know, be careful tonight. There's a lot of this. There's a lot of that. Or, you know, be careful in the game, son. You know, you're going up a big team and the guys, you know, the guy's actually a little heavier than you, and just pay attention and, you know, hey, make sure you watch your blind side. You know, my son's comment always was, Dad, I got this. You know, quit worrying about me. Dad, I got this. I mean, it was like his saying, no matter any time you tried to, you know, hey, you're going out tonight. Hey, you got to be home. But Dad, don't worry about it. I got this. And he was just, that was his favorite saying to us. Don't worry, Dad. You know,
yeah,
nothing's going to happen. It was just part of our life, you know, and we heard it so many times. And, you know, of course, you know, we thought he had that night, but obviously he didn't. And unfortunately for us, we got to live through it, and all his friends, you know.
Sure.
Again, like I said, you know, sometimes I worry about kids in high school, and we hear about it a lot. And I remember the kid in my high school, or in my junior high, that was kind of the loner. Well, Brett wasn't that guy at all.
Mm-hmm.
But you see what goes on in some of this stuff, and we all knew that guy. And that guy's usually somebody that never has a chance. And unfortunately, it's what we want to be able to do is give that kid a chance. Even if, you know, and that's one of the things that Cheryl's so good at is we help these kids. We walk them through the process because
right.
they don't know what to do. You know, there's scholarships in high school, and, you know, they sit there and go, hey, I'll never get one. There's no way. Why bother? And we kind of coach him through all that because, you know, at the end of the day, that's what we do want to do. We want to take the kid that had no chance, like the one we talked about that's in the seminary school, and, you know, and watch him get 4.0, you know, and like writing us a letter, sending his grades and go, thank you so much. You know, you just don't know what you mean. And the other thing that we're doing is, you know, we'd like to reinvent the wheel, but like this particular individual, you know, he's doing so well that we're giving him, you know, we're re-upping him for his sophomore year.
Oh, that's
and
great.
So, you know, it's not like we're just like getting him in school and then saying, hey, now you got to fend for yourself. Instead of starting over, we're just going to continue on with this individual and get him all the way home.
That is fantastic. We're talking with Bill and Vicky Atkins with the Brett Atkins Foundation. You guys give out 27 $5,000 scholarship to high school kids who say no to drugs. Now, how do the kids apply for these scholarships? Are they writing letters to you? What is the process?
The process is to go on the BrettAtkinsFoundation.org website, and they can apply there. And it will walk you through what you need to say and why you feel that you deserve this scholarship. So you can go on the website and apply there.
And hey, Chris, it's really easy, too. I just tell people, if you just Google Brett Atkins, and it's spelled A-D-K-I-N-S, or if you even put the name Atkins in there, it's probably going to pop up on the homepage. And that's a good thing, right? And, you know,
sure.
at the end of the day, we don't want people trying to, you know, find. And it's just, you know, it's a form. And so it's simple for that as far as that goes.
You know. I'm wondering how you guys feel when you're able to give out these scholarships to the students. How do you feel about awarding them? Because I know reading the letters and reading through some of what these kids are going through or what they're trying to fend off, it probably makes you feel good, but also makes you feel like, again, I mentioned this earlier, taking a tragic situation and turning it into a blessing.
Well, hey, Chris, you know, we're not above asking for donations, and you know, and if anybody knows me, I'm not afraid to ask. And hey, I'll ask right now. Anything you could do to help the organization, feel
sure,
free
to partner up
to it. Because it's not money that we're wasting. Trust me, and we, the Atkins family, we are heavily involved, and we are heavily donors, and we'll continue this process. But you know what? We had 1,100. Plus applications last 1,100.
Wow!
So it's really disheartening to think that we have to pick the 27. You know, we would like to say, hey, it's going to be 47.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And but unfortunately, we also want this to go on for as long as we possibly can. And we got to be, you know, again, we can't save every kid, but we can't we can make sure that we save them one at a time. And, you know, it's a difficult process. You sit there and go, man, I can't believe.
The challenges out there,
yeah. We have a board of directors, and we all sit down and we read all the, you know, and we just go, hey, here's our 27th, you know, and believe it or not, a couple of them, you know, sent back things that, hey, we got a scholarship from my academics, don't need it. That's great when we just move down the line and pass it to the runner-up. But like I said, it's one of those things that, and we'll help. We'll help you get through the process. And it's, you know, that's why a lot of people don't bother with it. And then they don't end up at school and, you know, the struggle and everything mm-hmm. else. But we want to help the ones that need help.
Well, we can't thank you guys enough for joining us. Vicki, is there anything you'd like to say before we part? Because I think you guys are doing an outstanding job, and this is a great opportunity for certain high schoolers applying for grants right now.
Well, I'd like to add that it is very rewarding to see our son's legacy continue on through the lives of the youth today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Brett would just say, don't let them win. Just keep doing what you're good at and just get across the finish line. And, you know, I want to see these kids succeed and make good choices and know that they all have a calling on their life and they can win with the right resources and the right people believing in them.
Vicki, Bill, it's been a great conversation, and thanks again for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Chris.
We appreciate it. We're grateful.
For sure. Bill and Vicki Atkins with the Brett Atkins Foundation, helping change lives of students applying for scholarships and saying no to drugs. And joining us now is Bob Williams, the CEO of the Ranch Hands Rescue and Bob's House of Hope. And you've got quite a story. I'm so glad you're able to join us this morning, because the two projects that you're involved with, starting with the Ranch Hands Rescue, is such a compelling story, and I think people need to know all about it, especially your newest organization, Bob's House of Hope, which is going to be the first ever in the United States safe house for young men who are sexually abused or sexually trafficked. So, Bob, thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
You know what? I really want to start out when you started with Ranch Hands Rescue, because that organization and that place is so important up there in Denton County. And can you tell people how you started that in 2008 and what it's all about?
Absolutely. You know, I always like about myself so they can kind of understand how we got here.
Sure.
You know, I grew up in Michigan, pretty normal family, but I was raped as a teenager. Mm. And my father was retired military. And when he picked me up from the hospital, he said, you know, you're just going to man up and we're never, ever going to talk about this again. And I was a junior in high school and, you know, I couldn't process it. And so I turned to drugs and alcohol. And I was accepted into West Point and the FBI Academy at Quantico. And, of course, I didn't go to either one of them. I was so damaged that I just didn't want to be alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was homeless by the time I was 20, active in my addiction in my 20s. I got clean and sober for the first time at 26, and I relapsed at 27, and I got clean and sober at 28, and I've been clean and sober ever since. In those days, there wasn't programs for boys, and so, you know, nobody really knew what to do, and I couldn't process what had happened to me. You know, I'm blessed that I never got into trouble, but I didn't want to die. And so, you know, I struggled through those years. I was homeless for a period of time at 20 for 9 months. And, you know, I struggled trying to keep a job and different things. And, you know, I didn't know how to deal with the trauma or what had happened to me. And so I tell everybody that, you know, I'm really one of the lucky ones, because when I got clean and sober, and, you know, I did every lousy job I think of. You know, I was a busboy, I cut sod, I just did, you know, a variety of meaningful labor jobs, but people really looked down on me. And, you know, when you have a history of being an addict, people don't want to give you a second chance. You know, here I am, I'm 28 years old, I don't have a college education, there's no place for me to really go, all right? And people really treated me horrible. And, of course, some of it I deserved because of my addiction and being in that, but in that, terrible time of my life with drugs and alcohol. But the reality is, here I am trying to put my life back together and get clean and sober. And so I used to send out resumes, and you'll probably get a kick out of this. You're too young to remember, but we really did need to send out resumes in those days. And,
right.
And my dad used to say to me, and by the way, I have to tell you, I hated my dad for a lot of years because I couldn't understand why he couldn't help me. But one day when I made amends with him, when I got sober, he said to me, you know, I loved you so much. He had tears in his eyes. He said, I didn't know how to help you. Mm-hmm. And it's true. You know, he was a World War II vet. And, you know, they just, as I said, there wasn't programs for boys. And he really didn't know how to help me. Oh, anyway, he said to me, you know, just keep sending out resumes. You never open them. And here I am trying to make my resume look like I'm a busboy, but I'm running the restaurant. And, mm-hmm. you know the drill, right? So one day I get this call from Motorola, asked me to come up interview. And, you know, I thought I died and went to heaven. And I go up and I interview before this panel of people. And then this guy brings me in. His name was Pat. And he said to me, you know, I just got to tell you, your resume is one of the worst I've ever seen. But I had to meet you because we have sent you 18 rejection letters and you keep sending in resumes. And, you know, I started laughing. So I told him my story, but I told him everything except that I was raped. But I did tell him that the struggles that I faced. And it turns out he was an alcoholic. And he goes, for 9 years, and Motorola helped me. They helped me put my life back together. And so I'm going to give you a shot. And he hired me as a sales guy. There wasn't a cell system like we have today. And you went around to different, you know, areas trying to sell people this $5,000 cell phone in a briefcase. And I became the number one sales guy in the country. So they promoted me to sales manager. And they said at that time, you know, if you want to get ahead in the company, you're going to have to get back in school. So Motorola put me back in school. And that was really the start of my healing. But 10 years into my career, and I was very fortunate that I had an amazing career with them, I knew I wasn't mentally healthy. Because when you have to, you know, when you have such fear to close your eyes at night and go to sleep, because I was found asleep when I was raped, all right, and I woke up with a knife to my throat, and I was brutally beaten, and I was raped. Mm-hmm. And when you have to sleep with a gun next to the bed, and when you have to get up 25 times a night and make sure the door is locked and that the windows are locked and you have to sleep with all the lights on, that's not normal. So I went to the Meadows in Wickenburg, Arizona, to really get the trauma therapy and the help that I needed so that I could have a full and productive life. And that was the first time that I talked about my rape and my trauma. And the woman who was one of my counselors was also a survivor, and she taught me how to be a survivor and not a victim. And that was a huge milestone in my life because it was like somebody had lifted 10,000 pounds of pressure off my shoulders, and I could now start to talk about it. And so I decided then that I was going to try to take that experience and help as many people as I could. And in 2007, I had a stroke. And I don't say this to sound pretentious, but my closest friend for 25 years was Doris Roberts, who was most famously known for playing the TV mom on the show Everybody Loves Raymond.
That's right.
So Doris had this old spring mattress in her bedroom, all right? You'd have thought with all her money she'd have bought a decent bed. But, you know, it was one of those ones from like the 30s. And when you moved, it had coils, all right? So I thought, you know, I woke up and my neck was hurting and my arm was numb. And I thought, well, I probably got a pinched nerve in my neck. Mm-hmm. And we were getting ready to go to lunch. And I told her, I said, you know, I don't feel good. I think I just want to lay down. And she called her doctor, all right? So he said, bring him in right away. And so we go in, and it turns out, he says, I think you're having a stroke. And so I got into the medical center, and I got that stroke medicine. And it saved my life because, you know, if you get it within a few hours of, mm-hmm. of symptoms, it really helps you. And so what happened was I had this amazing career at Motorola. But at the same time, one of my close friends, dear friends, Jeffrey Frost, he had a heart attack in London, and he died because they couldn't get medical care to him. And I thought, you know, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be in India or someplace and have something. It was a real big wake-up call for me, all right? Mm-hmm. So I decided to retire in 2007 and do something that I loved. So I started to, Doris and I, we talked every day. And, you know, I learned everything about animals and animal cruelty from our old sheriff here in Denton County, Benny Park. He's since passed away, but I started saving animals just as something to do. And I thought, you know, they had this amazing effect on me. And I'd go to the heart doctor and to the neurosurgeon, and they'd say, you know, what's happening to you? You're kind of like a different person, because I've always been a little high strung and a little high maintenance, you know. And so I was telling Doris about it, and she said, well, you know, have you ever thought about starting an animal sanctuary? And if you want to do that, I'll help you. I'll help you raise money. And I said, well, I want to do more than that. You know, I want to help people too. But at that time, I just didn't understand how that was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that with being diagnosed with PTSD and high anxiety, that there was something to this. So we started off originally in 2008. We filed our public charity status. In 2009, we got our public charity status. And so we started off as a rescue. And then I started doing a tremendous amount of research on counseling and mental health therapy. And there's a tremendous amount of data, Chris, on the power of horses and mental health therapy. We know the benefits of riding therapy and mental health therapy. There's a tremendous amount of data about, we know dogs lower blood pressure in hospitals and nursing homes and things like that. And so we get all this with companion animals.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not one piece of data in the entire country. As a matter of fact, we're the first to publish it, about the power of abused and neglected animals in mental health. So what I did is I established a sanctuary for specifically special needs animals. And I call them the throwaways, because they're the ones that nobody wants. Typically, animals that are blind, or they've been seized for abuse or neglect, or they've got broken bones, they're the most expensive to rehabilitate. So most organizations just euthanize them. And as a matter of fact, law enforcement was in a case where they'd say, okay, nobody wants to take this horse with a broken leg or whatever the case is,
mm-hmm.
and they would just put them down, all right? And I thought, you know, those animals are kind of like me. You know, they're the throwaways. They're just as important as the ones that are healthy, and they deserve to have a place that they can live a full and productive life and just be a horse or a sheep or, you know, whatever it is. And on the animal side, you know, we have 57 special needs animals. We've done the first ever prosthetic leg in a horse without amputation in 2010. We did the first ever stem cell transplant in a horse with nanofiber technology to heal the tendon without scar tissue. We did the first ever open heart surgery in a sheep that's ever been done in the world. And we had a lot of these things that we did just because I thought, you know, if they can do it for people, they can do it for animals. And they did. And we even have a dog with three prosthetic legs today.
My goodness.
So what happened was, I'd reach out to all these people and I'd say, you know what, I got this idea. I want to develop a counseling program, but I want to take all the things I like from all the years of counseling that I've had, and I want to develop a program where we partner animals with people that have suffered severe trauma, and I want to specialize in kids. Because I couldn't process what happened to me at 17. I couldn't imagine a 6-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 13-year-old being able to process, you know, any type of sexual or physical abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody turned me down. Everybody said, nope, it's not going to work. You got to have healthy animals. It's just, you know, nice thought, but it's not going to work. So I finally found this counselor by the name of Kim, and she was doing work with kids that have been sexually abused using healthy horses. And I met with her, and I went through my whole life story with her, and I talked about this, all these ideas that I had. And she looked at me and she said, you know, I admire you for what, you know, that you want to help people, but this just isn't going to work. You got to have healthy animals. And I said, no, I really think there's something here. Well, you know, the one thing I learned from Doris, Chris, and you'll relate to this as a host, radio host, but she had this motto, and it was, I don't give in, I don't give up, I don't take no for an answer, and I never, ever settle. And that resonated with me, because Doris wasn't only a close friend, but she was a role model and a mm-hmm. mentor to me. And so I just kept pounding Kim, you know, saying, hey, would you please give us some thought? Well, finally, I guess she got tired of me calling her. She goes, okay, I'll bring a couple of kids up there and I'll try it. And she called me up and she said, let's meet. And so we met and she said, you know, I think you're onto something here. So her and I sat down and we designed this, you know, comprehensive counseling program. And we finished it. And of course, you know, now where do I take it? So I took it to the Children's Advocacy Centers. And I thought, you know, they're doing such great work with kids that let me take it to them and see what they think. So we gave their clinical team this incredible presentation. And the executive director looked at me and said, oh, my God, Bob, I love this. This is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And this was in 2010. And I said, incredible. When can we start? And he goes, no. We got 21 counselors. I just think you're going to do amazing things in the community with this. So I said to him, I said, can I ask you a question? And he said, absolutely. And I said, can you save every child? And he thought for a minute and he said, no. And I looked at him and I said, then where did they go? And he looked at me and he said, you know what? You got something there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the start of our pilot program in 2010, working with the Children's Advocacy Centers. And so the best way to think about this is in any segment of the population, even though we specialize in kids that have been sexually abused and sex trafficked, our program really works for anyone. There's about 1 to 8% of any segment of the population, whether it's kids that have been sexually abused or sex trafficked, whether it's battered women, whether it's veterans with severe PTSD and anxiety, whatever the case is,
mm-hmm.
they don't respond to traditional office therapy. Those are the clients that need a different or more alternative progressive approach to mental health, and that's where the animals come in. Our criteria, Chris, for free services or subsidized services is that an individual must have been in a program previously and they failed. So our referrals, we have 28 partner agencies in the Metroplex that we work with that refer clients to us that are regressing. So when you see kids, for example, it's typically kids that have had long-term abuse or sexual abuse, multiple abusers, that sort of thing. When mm-hmm. they regress, you start seeing all kinds of additional symptoms that they start to manifest. So when they're not getting better, you see eating disorders, extreme anger, self-mutilation. We probably have 15 kids in our program right now. They're cutting their forehead, their cheeks, mm-hmm. that sort
their
of thing.
Their arms and stuff, yeah.
Yeah. It's all these outcries, right? And so our counseling team and our psychologists are like trauma surgeons because they're dealing with severe case after severe case, not just dealing with the original trauma, but they're dealing with all the other things that have manifested. And it's completely normal what these kids are going through or these individuals. 80% of our program is kids who have suffered this type of abuse, and 20% is made up of veterans, battered women, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was the program started to become recognized, you know, around the country, and people started talking about it. And then more and more partners came on, and people were interested in what's really making this work. And then we worked with universities to help develop testing for us, because you can't test a 6-year-old the same way you test a 15-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
A boy is different than a girl, you know, those sorts of things in terms of ages and so on. And now we're working with the University of Oregon to develop not only additional testing, but they're going to validate our testing and they're going to publish it. It is off the charts exceptional in terms of how many people we've helped, thousands of people, and how great they're doing in terms of getting to the root of their trauma. But it's not just animal therapy. We have to be able to do all the other modalities, EMDR and CBT and sand therapy and play therapy and those kinds of things, because these cases are so complex. You know, you got to kind of throw the kitchen sink at it. My clinical team hates this, but the bottom line is you take the best of what you think is going to work. You know, mm-hmm. we get kids in, they don't speak. You know, they didn't speak when they were at Children's Hospital or wherever they were at because mm-hmm. their trauma is so severe. They're referred to us, and they may not speak right away with us either. But there's again, that bond, and I can give you several stories as we kind of get through this of how it works. But
go right ahead.
I'll give an example of a 13-year-old girl who, and this was a big news story, sexual abuse story here in the Metroplex, and she didn't speak for months. And we got this horse in who had been beaten with a feed bucket, and her jaw was wired shut.
Wow.
So this little girl, you know, previously at the Advocacy Center. She didn't talk. She was referred to us. She didn't speak with us for 2 months. So, you know, here we are. We're trying everything, and she just wouldn't talk. She just hung her head down. And so when this horse came in, all of a sudden, the counselor's out in the pasture with her, and she looks at her counselor and says, "What happened to that horse?" Well, I mean, nobody could believe it. That just those were the words that came right out of her mouth. And so the counselor explained, well, the horse was beaten with a feed bucket, and law enforcement seized the horse, and he's had to have his mouth wired. She's had to have her mouth wired shut. And so the little girl then went on and said, my daddy locked me in the closet. He hurt me. He used to beat me with a dog leash. I mean, it all just came out.
Wow.
Right. And I mean, we all cried, and her foster parents cried. All right. Because this was almost 6 months of absolutely no verbal communication with anybody, including her family. And so we know that some kids, some people will tell an animal something before they will tell an adult in a traditional office environment. And because the trauma is so severe, you know, with sex trafficking, and I'll get into a little bit about how Bob's House of Hope was, you know, came underway, but there's not a rational person that can understand or comprehend, Chris, what these kids go through.
Mm-hmm.
And so about 4 years ago, so we've always had sex trafficking victims, but they were women in our program, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the youngest sex trafficking victim that we had was 6 years old. This was a major case here in Denton County, but nobody knew the child was with us. And it was a big sex trafficking case. And the young lady is now adopted and out of state. But anyhow, she was in our program for a couple of years. And what happened was they were forming a coalition in North Texas to talk about human trafficking and ways to combat it. So they asked me if I would join. And, you know, I go to this meeting, and there's all these people from law enforcement, Homeland Security, and there's judges, and there's detention officers for kids, and, you know, all these different people. And I'm myself and one other person are the only lay people in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I really didn't know why they wanted me there other than, you know, we could provide some healing aspects to what we're doing with sex trafficking victims, all right? And at that time, they were all women.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just raised my hand one day, and I said, can I ask a question? And Judge McCary, who's one of our local judges here at Denton, said, absolutely. And I said, is there a problem with boys? And she looked at me and she said, Bob, it's the single biggest problem in the country today, and nobody's talking about it. And this was approximately 3 years ago. And so I thought, oh, and she said, I think you're the perfect person to look into this and see really what's happening. So I started doing all kinds of research on were boys being sex trafficked and what was happening. And then if you looked at the national data back then, they'd say 10% of boys are being sex trafficked. And I'm like, well, that can't be right with the stories that we're starting to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to question it. And then I realized that not only so how this all came about was I was doing a TV interview, and this doctor said, well, you know, I'm sorry, but because I said, well, we think that up to 50% of human trafficking victims are boys or young men. And she said to me, well, no, I think that's incorrect, because if you look at the national data, blah, blah, blah. And then I said to her, well, can you tell me how you capture that data? And she said, well, it's basically just overflow from when, you know, when we do stings or when there's arrests, you know, sometimes they find boys. All right. And I'm like, well, there's nothing specific to boys. I mean, has anybody ever really looked at this data and said, how big of a problem is this? And she couldn't answer the question. So I said, okay, now we're on to something here. Okay. We know that not only is there a lack of data, but there's a complete lack of training. So now is where it really gets interesting. So a couple of years ago, Governor Abbott said, look, this is a big problem with boys and young men being human trafficked. So we're going to form a task force, and we're going to try to figure out how big is the problem and what do we do to fix it and provide resources, and then how do we arrest the traffickers? And so they asked me to be on it, which I'm very proud to serve on. I also serve on the Attorney General's Task Force for Human Trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where my eyes were really open to the fact that not only is this happening, but people have no idea how to, you know, what to look for with boys, because the myth is that they can get away. So we call them the unseen survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is then we started to realize, as the word got out, we started talking about this, that our phones were ringing. People were saying to me, you know, we have an 18-year-old sex trafficking victim. You know, we don't have a place to put him. When I started Ranch Hands Rescue, Chris, I only wanted to fill a void. I started a sanctuary for special needs animals because there wasn't one. I developed a counseling program for individuals that 1% to 8% of people or kids that need a different or more alternative, you know, solution to mental health therapy because there wasn't one. And now I'm opening the first safe house in the country for young men that have been sex trafficked 18 to 24 years old because there isn't one.
Will your treatments be different than what you do, you know, with the Ranch Hands Rescue? Is it going to be somewhat similar?
What we've got to do with these young men and with what they've been through is to, first of all, we got to give them hope, all right? This safe house, we're going to do several things with it. Number one, we're going to put God in their life, and we're going to teach them what their higher power is.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be very difficult because of what they've been through. You know, sex trafficking is a $1 billion-a-year industry, and many of these young men have been trafficked to different people 6, 8, 10 times a day. All right. So, having said that, we're going to give them a safe environment to live in. We're going to teach them a trade or put them back in school. We're going to give them all of the psychological, psychiatric, and counseling that they need, all right, in order to heal them. We're going to understand, is their mental illness combined with this addiction? We're going to deal with the trauma that they've been through and the trauma bonding that they have for the traffickers. You know, it's kind of, people talk about it or refer to it as the Patty Hearst syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
It's this very sick affection for the people that have hurt you, but it's because of the way they drug them up, demean them. You know, they want to keep them under their thumb. And we're going to bring awareness to this situation. We're going to have a mentoring program where we leverage our veterans, both men and women. We're going to have a grandparenting program. I believe that through our actions that we're going to be able to not only restore hope, but we're going to give them the help that they need. This is a long-term care program. It's a minimum 2 years and most likely 3 years. You know, you can't flip these people after what they've been through overnight. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take time to be able to teach them how to rebuild trust again, enter society. You know, law enforcement deals with these kids on a daily basis because they have survival sex and they do things to make money. You know, they rob and they do different things,
sure,
to make money because so let's talk about this for a second. The foster care system really is an incredible system, right? And every system's got its issues. But the foster care system has an incredible transition program for kids coming out, you know, aging out for 18 to 22 years old. But here's the problem. You got a kid that's been in the system his whole life, all right? And he's been sexually abused or physically abused, bullied, whatever the situation is. And he turns 18, and they just want to get out on the street, but yet they don't have any life skills. They don't understand how to interview for a job. They don't have a car. So here they leave. They're out on their own, all right? And all of a sudden, they're having survival sex or doing things just to survive because they don't know how to live. You know what I mean? They've
mm-hmm.
never been taught. And so that's the challenge. And predators prey on vulnerable kids. You would be shocked at the amount of autistic kids. You know, all multicultural groups, Chris,
right,
that are lower income are at risk. Everybody's
right
at risk because it's happening in every community. If you have a kid that's vulnerable, a predator is going to figure out how to get to them.
By the way, Bob, how do you find the kids in order to help them? Are these kids runaways? Are they kidnapped? Are they with their families, but they're just not saying what's going on? I mean, how are you able to? I mean, I'm sure there's some adults who may find out about your program. Is it law enforcement that knows about your program, Bob's House of Hope?
Yeah, so primarily our calls come from law enforcement. So, you know, with the new way of policing today, and by the way, we're working with police departments to train them on, what to look for with these young men, because we call them the unseen survivors, you know, because of the stigma associated with this.
Right.
There are many people that are afraid of their traffickers, so they don't want to come forward. We're teaching them on what to look for and how to identify these young men. But to your point, Chris, the majority of them will come from law enforcement or from partner agencies who have outreach centers in various cities across the country. We can take kids from anywhere in the country. I call them kids, but I'm talking about this segment of 18 to 24.
Mm-hmm.
And they typically identify them. And then we have a series of criteria that we go through because we want them prosecuting their traffickers.
Sure.
Now, most people think of the movie Taken, all right? The reality is that many of these young people are trafficked by their own family, all right?
Wow.
It's major money, yeah, or a relative.
Mm-hmm.
We have a 15-year-old boy who mother died when he was four, adopted by an uncle, trafficked for 8 years to both men and women, and animals were brought into the trafficking.
Wow.
There's not one rational person that can even comprehend that. Now, he's in jail, and that whole group is in jail, but the child is going to need forever counseling, all right? Extremely angry, doesn't know if he's gay, straight, you know, bisexual, transgender, I mean,
sure.
Very confused, and a tremendous amount of issues. That's a very difficult situation to sort through. I mean, teenagers have enough issues. But for this kid, you know, and he came to us through Children's Hospital. So the challenge here is not only identifying him, but, you know, we rescued a young man with one of our partners and with law enforcement, because we always do everything with law enforcement, from South Texas. And when the police officers got him to the hospital didn't know how to do a rape kit on a boy. There's just a tremendous amount of education that needs to happen, and awareness. And this morning in the press conference, our sheriff stood up and said, you know, he's been doing this for 30 years. And he wonders, you know, did he come in contact with people, you know, young people and not know that they were being trafficked? Because this is now just coming to light. But if we don't keep this dialogue up, and if we don't start educating people that, you know, the average age that boys are targeted on the internet is 13, that this is happening in our community, that our kids are vulnerable, social media is the worst, worst thing for any parent, right? Because it's like Disneyland for predators.
Yes, and there's the bullies and bots and everything out there. People can disguise themselves and be keyboard tough guys.
Right, right. And then on top of that, Chris, there are websites now. So you have these young people, many of them who are trafficking themselves, and we call it third-party trafficking. The trafficker is the website. They get on these sites, and they're doing, you know, porn or whatever, and people subscribe to it for $3.99 a month or $4.99 a month, right? And so these kids think it's easy money. They're trafficking themselves without understanding that they're really involved in trafficking. But the site is the actual trafficker, because
right.
They're the conduit to make it happen. And then these kids, they start making money, and most of them are college students. And then all of a sudden they decide they're going to go meet somebody, whether it's a male or a female. And keep in mind, 35% of predators are female, right?
Okay.
So, yeah. So what happens then is they meet the wrong person and it's over. You know what I mean? And they're able to control them, because they manipulate them with drugs and alcohol and fear, right? So it is actual human slavery.
This is an amazing story, and this is an amazing work that you're doing. Can you give people a website or a location how they can get in touch with either you or your staff, with Ranch Hands Rescue, or with the new project you're working on, Bob's House of Hope?
Right. I will be happy to do that. I appreciate you sharing it. So our website is real simple. It's www.ranchhandrescue.org. And our office number is 240-0500.
Oh, we're so glad you're able to join us. This was a courageous conversation, a topic that a lot of people know about but are have ideas and questions about, and you basically shared it. And, again, we've got to check back in with you later down the road to see how things are going and also find out some more things about Bob's House of Hope and Ranch Hands Rescue. Bob Williams, the CEO, thanks again for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for your kindness, and I hope you have a blessed day. I appreciate you.
You too, Bob. I'm Chris Arnold of 105.3 The Fan. Thank you for joining me. Tune in next week as we focus on our other organizations doing great things in our community right here on Better Living.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.